Chapter 46. Going to the birthday feast, the 30th of July was come, and it was one of those half dozen warm days which sometimes occur in the middle of a rainy English summer. No rain had fallen for the last 3 or 4 days, and the weather was perfect for that time of the year. There was less dust than usual on the dark green hedgerows, and on the wild chamomile that starred the roadside, yet the grass was dry enough for the little children to roll on it, and there was no cloud, but a long dash of light, downy ripple, high, high up in the far-off blue sky. Perfect weather for an outdoor July merrymaking, yet surely not the best time of year to be born in. Nature seems to make a hot pause just then. All the loveliest flowers are gone, the sweet time of early growth and vague hopes is past, and yet the time of harvest and ingathering is not come, and we tremble at the possible storms that may ruin the precious fruit in the moment of its ripeness. The woods are all one dark monotonous green, the wagon loads of hay no longer creep along the lanes, scattering their sweet-smelling fragments on the blackberry branches. The pastures are often a little tanned, yet the corn has not got its last splendor of red and gold. The lambs and calves have lost all traces of their innocent frisky prettiness, and have become stupid young sheep and cows. But it is a time of leisure on the farm, that pause between hay and corn harvest, and so the farmers and laborers in Aislip and Broxton thought the captain did well to come of age just then, when they could give their undivided minds to the flavor of the great cask of ale which had been brewed the autumn, after Pierre was born, and was to be tapped on his 21st birthday. Pierre had been merry with the ringing of church bells very early this morning, and everyone had made haste to get through the needful work before 12, when it would be time to think of getting ready to go to the chase. The midday sun was streaming into Hetty's bedchamber, and there was no blind to temper the heat with which it fell on her head as she looked at herself in the old specked glass. Still, that was the only glass he had in which he could see her neck and arms, for the small hanging glass he had fetched out of the next room, the room that had been Dinah's, would show her nothing below her little chin, and that beautiful bit of neck, where the roundness of her cheek melted into another roundness shadowed by dark delicate curls. And today she thought more than usual about her neck and arms, for at the dance this evening she was not to wear any neckerchief, and as he had been busy yesterday with her spotted pink and white frock, that she might make the sleeves either long or short at will. She was dressed now just as she was to be in the evening, with a tucker made of eel lace, which her aunt had lent her for this unparalleled occasion, but with no ornaments besides, as he had even taken out her small round earrings which she wore every day. But there was something more to be done, apparently, before she put on her neckerchief and long sleeves, which she was to wear in the daytime, for now she unlocked the drawer that held her private treasures. It is more than a month since we saw her unlock that drawer before, and now it holds new treasures, so much more precious than the old ones, that these are thrust into the corner. Hetty would not care to put the large colored glass earrings into her ears now. For see, as he has got a beautiful pair of gold and pearls and garnet, lying snugly in a pretty little box lined with white satin. Oh, the delight of taking out that little box and looking at the earrings. Do not reason about it, my philosophical reader, and say that Hetty, being very pretty, must have known that it did not signify whether she had on any ornaments or not, and that, moreover, to look at earrings which she could not possibly wear out of her bedroom could hardly be a satisfaction, the essence of vanity being a reference to the impressions produced on others. You will never understand women's natures if you are so excessively rational. Try rather to divest yourself of all your rational prejudices, as much as if you were studying the psychology of a canary bird, and only watch the movements of this pretty round creature as she turns her head on one side with an unconscious smile at the earrings nestled in the little box. Ah, you think it is for the sake of the person who has given them to her, and her thoughts are gone back now to the moment when they were put into her hands. No. Else why should she have cared to have earrings, rather than anything else? And I know that as he had longed for earrings from among all the ornaments she could imagine. Little ears, Arthur had said, pretending to pinch them one evening, as Hetty sat beside him on the grass without her hat. I wish I had some pretty earrings, she said in a moment, almost before she knew what she was saying. The wish lay so close to her lips, it would flutter past them at the slightest breath. And the next day, it was only last week, Arthur had ridden over to Rossiter on purpose to buy them. That little wish so naively uttered seemed to him the prettiest bit of childishness. He had never heard anything like it before, and he had wrapped the box up in a great many covers, that he might see Hetty unwrapping it with growing curiosity, till at last her eyes flashed back their new delight into his. No, she was not thinking most of the giver, when she smiled at the earrings, for now she is taking them out of the box, not to press them to her lips, but to fasten them in her ears only for one moment, to see how pretty they look, as she peeps at them in the glass against the wall, with first one position of the head and then another, like a listening bird. It is impossible to be wise on the subject of earrings as one looks at her. What should those delicate pearls and crystals be made for, if not for such ears? One cannot even find fault with the tiny round hole which they leave when they are taken out. Perhaps water nixies, and such lovely things without souls, have these little round holes in their ears by nature, ready to hang jewels in. And Hetty must be one of them. It is too painful to think that she is a woman, with a woman's destiny before her, a woman spinning in young ignorance a light web of folly, and vain hopes which may one day close round her, and press upon her, a rancorous poisoned garment, changing all at once her fluttering, trivial butterfly sensations into a life of deep human anguish. But she cannot keep in the earrings long, else she may make her uncle and aunt wait. She puts them quickly into the box again, and shuts them up. Someday she will be able to wear any earrings she likes, and already she lives in an invisible world of brilliant costumes, shimmering gauze, soft satin, and velvet, such as the lady's maid at the Chase has shown her in Miss Lydia's wardrobe. She feels the bracelets on her arms, and treads on the soft carpet in front of a tall mirror. But as he has one thing in the drawer which she can venture to wear today, because she can hang it on the chain of dark brown berries which as he has been used to wear on grand days, with a tiny flat scent bottle at the end of it tucked inside her frock, and she must put on her brown berries, her neck would look so unfinished without it. Hetty was not quite as fond of the locket as of the earrings, though it was a handsome large locket, with enameled flowers at the back, and a beautiful gold border round the glass, which showed a light brown slightly waving lock, forming a background for two little dark rings. She must keep it under her clothes, and no one would see it. But Hetty had another passion, only a little less strong than her love of finery, and that other passion made her like to wear the locket even hidden in her bosom. She would always have worn it, if as he had dared to encounter her aunt's questions about a ribbon round her neck. So now she slipped it on along her chain of dark brown berries, and snapped the chain round her neck. It was not a very long chain, only allowing the locket to hang a little way below the edge of her frock. And now as he had nothing to do but to put on her long sleeves, her new white gauze neckerchief, and her straw hat trimmed with white today instead of the pink, which had become rather faded under the July sun. That hat made the drop of bitterness in Hetty's cup today, for it was not quite new. Everybody would see that it was a little tanned against the white ribbon, and Mary Birch, she felt sure, would have a new hat or bonnet on. She looked for consolation at her fine white cotton stockings. They really were very nice indeed, and as he had given almost all her spare money for them. Hetty's dream of the future could not make her insensible to triumph in the present. To be sure, Captain Donathan loved her, so that he would never care about looking at other people, but then those other people didn't know how he loved her, and she was not satisfied to appear shabby and insignificant in their eyes even for a short space. The whole party was assembled in the house place when Eddie went down, all of course in their Sunday clothes, and the bells had been ringing, so this morning in honor of the captain's 21st birthday, and the work had all been got done so early, that Marty and Tommy were not quite easy in their minds until their mother had assured them that going to church was not part of the day's festivities. Mr. Poyser had once suggested that the house should be shut up and left to take care of itself. For, said he, there's no danger of anybody's breaking in, everybody'll be at the chase, thieves and all. If we lock TH house up, all the men can go. It's a day they wanna see twice i their lives. But Mrs. Poyser answered with great decision. Never left the house, to take care of itself, since I was a missus, and I never will. There's been ill-looking tramps anew about the place this last week, to carry off every ham and every spoon when got, and they all collogged together, them tramps, as it's a mercy they hadna come and poisoned the dogs, and murdered us all in our beds afore we knowed, some Friday night when got the money in TH house to pay the men. And it's like enough the tramps know where we're going as well as we do Urson's. For if old Harry wants any work done, you may be sure he'll find the means. Nonsense about murdering us in our beds, said Mr. Poyser. I've got a gun in our room, and I? And thee'st got ears as ud find it out, if a mouse was gnawing the bacon. However, if thee wants'na be easy, a lick can stay at home by the fore part o' the day, and Tim can come back towards 5 o'clock, and let a lick have his turn. They may let Growler loose, if anybody offers to do mischief, and there's a lick's dog too, ready enough to set his tooth in a tramp, if a lick gives him a wink. Mrs. Poyser accepted this compromise, but thought it advisable to bar and bolt to the utmost. And now, at the last moment before starting, Nancy, the dairy maid, was closing the shutters of the house place, although the window, lying under the immediate observation of a lick and the dogs, might have been supposed the least likely to be selected for a burglarious attempt. The covered cart, without springs, was standing ready to carry the whole family except the men servants. Mr. Poyser and the grandfather sat on the seat in front, and within there was room for all the women and children. The fuller the cart the better, because then the jolting would not hurt so much, and Nancy's broad person and thick arms were an excellent cushion to be pitched on. But Mr. Poyser drove at no more than a walking pace, that there might be as little risk of jolting as possible on this warm day, and there was time to exchange greetings and remarks with the foot passengers who were going the same way, specking the paths between the green meadows and the golden cornfields with bits of movable bright color, a scarlet waistcoat to match the poppies that nodded a little too thickly among the corn, or a dark blue neckerchief with ends flaunting across a brand new white smock frock. All Broxton and all Haislip were to be at the chase, and make merry there in honor of H. Eyre, and the old men and women, who had never been so far down this side of the hill for the last 20 years, were being brought from Broxton and Haislip in one of the farmer's wagons, at Mr. Irwin's suggestion. The church bells had struck up again now a last tune, before the ringers came down the hill, to have their share in the festival. And before the bells had finished, other music was heard approaching, so that even old Brown, the sober horse, that was drawing Mr. Poyser's cart, began to prick up his ears. It was the band of the Benefit Club, which had mustered in all its glory, that is to say, in bright blue scarfs and blue favors, and carrying its banner with the motto, "Let Brotherly Love Continue," encircling a picture of a stone pit. The carts, of course, were not to enter the chase. Everyone must get down at the lodges, and the vehicles must be sent back. Why, the chase is like a fair arity, said Mrs. Poyser, as she got down from the cart, and saw the groups scattered under the great oaks, and the boys running about in the hot sunshine, to survey the tall poles surmounted by the fluttering garments that were to be the prize of the successful climbers. Should ha thought there wasna so many people i the two parishes. Mercy on us. How hot it is out o' the shade. Come here, Toddy, else your little face'll be burnt to a scratchin'. they might hot cook the dinners I had open space, and save the fires. I shall go to Mrs. Best's room and sit down. Stop a bit, said Mr. Poyser. Here's T.H. wagon coming, why T.H. old folks in't. It'll be such a sight as wanna come or again, to see 'em get down and walk along all together. You remember some on the my there prime, eh, father? Aye, said old Martin, walking slowly under the shade of the lodge porch, from which he could see the aged party descend. Remember Jacob Taft walking 50 mile after the Scotch Rabels, when they turned back from Stoniton. He felt himself quite a youngster, with a long life before him, as he saw the Hayslip patriarch, old Feather Taft, descend from the wagon and walk towards him, in his brown knit cap, and leaning on his two sticks. Well, Mr. Taft, shouted old Martin, at the utmost stretch of his voice, for, though he knew the old man was stone deaf, he could not omit the propriety of a greeting oor hearty yet. You can enjoy yoursen today, for all your 90 and better. Your sarvant, mesters, your sarvant, said Feather Taft in a treble tone, perceiving that he was in company. The aged group, under care of sons or daughters, themselves worn and gray, passed on along the least winding carriage road towards the house, where a special table was prepared for them, while the Poyser party wisely struck across the grass under the shade of the great trees, but not out of view of the house front, with its sloping lawn and flower beds, or of the pretty striped marquee at the edge of the lawn, standing at right angles with two larger marquees on each side of the open green space, where the games were to be played. The house would have been nothing but a plain square mansion of Queen Anne's time, but for the remnant of an old abbey to which it was united at one end, in much the same way as one may sometimes see a new farmhouse rising high and prim at the end of older and lower farm offices. The fine old remnant stood a little backward and under the shadow of tall beeches, but the sun was now on the taller and more advanced front, the blinds were all down, and the house seemed asleep in the hot midday. It made Hetty quite sad to look at it. Arthur must be somewhere in the back rooms, with the grand company, where he could not possibly know that she was come, and she should not see him for a long, long while, not till after dinner, when they said he was to come up and make a speech. But Hetty was wrong in part of her conjecture. No grand company was come except the Irwins, for whom the carriage had been sent early, and Arthur was at that moment not in a back room, but walking with the rector into the broad stone cloisters of the old abbey, where the long tables were laid for all the cottage tenants and the farm servants. A very handsome young Briton he looked today, in high spirits and a bright blue frock coat, the highest mode his arm no longer in a sling. So open-looking and candid too, but candid people have their secrets, and secrets leave no lines in young faces. Upon my word, he said, as they entered the cool cloisters, I think the cottagers have the best of it. These cloisters make a delightful dining room on a hot day. That was capital advice of yours, Irwin, about the dinners, to let them be as orderly and comfortable as possible, and only for the tenants. Especially as I had only a limited sum after all, for though my grandfather talked of a carte blanche, he couldn't make up his mind to trust me when it came to the point. Never mind, you'll give more pleasure in this quiet way, said Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.